Today is Monday, May 17th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Gina Dufour, broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
Israeli artillery were fired on Gaza Monday morning as hostilities entered a second week.
Coming up, Israel-Palestine conflict rages on.
The new CDC guidance has revived discussion around a vaccine card so that businesses and others know if people have been inoculated.
Plus, Americans grapple with new CDC mask guidelines. Also, WHO links long work hours to increase risk of stroke and heart disease. Our top story today is in Israel. Israel bombed what it said were underground tunnels used by Hamas, and Palestinian militants fired rocket barrages at Israeli cities as fighting spilled into a second week on Monday amid mounting international calls for a ceasefire. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Israeli artillery were fired on Gaza Monday morning as hostilities entered a second week. Overnight, Israel launched dozens of airstrikes on Gaza and the Hamas Islamists who ruled the strip where 2 million Palestinians live. The sound of explosions roared as dozens of fighter jets bombed what Israel said were underground tunnels used by Hamas. Meanwhile, militants in the Palestinian enclave fired rockets at the southern Israeli cities of Beersheba and Ashkelon. Israeli aircraft struck 9 residences belonging to high-ranking Hamas commanders, the military said. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel's campaign in Gaza was continuing at full force and that deterrence had to be achieved to prevent future conflict with Hamas. US President Joe Biden said his administration was working with all parties to achieve sustained calm.
We also believe Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live in safety and security and enjoy equal measure of freedom, prosperity, and democracy.
Yet there's no sign of an end to hostilities, despite international calls for a ceasefire. It follows a crescendo of global concern over the weekend after an Israeli airstrike in Gaza destroyed several homes, killing 42 people, including 10 children.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. U.S. President Joe Biden said his administration is working with Palestinians and Israelis to build a sustained calm, adding that both deserve to live in safety and security. That's U.S. President Joe Biden.
We also believe Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live in safety and security and enjoy equal measure of freedom, prosperity, and democracy. And my administration is going to continue to engage Palestinians and Israelis and other regional partners to work towards sustained calm.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Sunday for an immediate ceasefire among Israelis and Palestinians. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir following a special Sunday Security Council meeting about the ongoing violence.
China, along with Norway and Tunisia, called for this emergency meeting as the violence continues to spiral. And their foreign ministers also spoke at the meeting. The Russian deputy foreign minister spoke. And then as interested parties, basically Jordan and Egypt spoke at the meeting, their foreign ministers. And basically everybody is trying to call for calm, but the two parties, Israel and the Palestinians, are kind of still pointing fingers at each other. And so really nothing was accomplished. We know everybody's positions. Their positions haven't changed, including the 15 members of the UN Security Council. But it was an exercise to say we are paying attention and we are very, very concerned that this is going to spiral out of control. But the bottom line is really there will be no change on the ground because the council met. And this is problematic because the council's credibility is at stake here and they can't seem to control this conflict or really, for that matter, any other.
Did they mention at all what they plan to do? Because as you mentioned when we last spoke, there are permanent members of the Security Council who can veto measures moving forward, but this meeting didn't come up with any results.
true. I mean, there were really there was no outcome. We learned that UN, Egypt, and Qatar are trying to broker this ceasefire that's going on. President Biden of the United States spoke yesterday with both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. One of the big things that was repeatedly brought up at this meeting, and I think it's important to talk about this time around, because unfortunately we've seen many rounds of violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians over the years. Children are really suffering. And UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, said on Sunday that 55 children in Palestine have been killed so far in Israeli airstrikes, and 2 children in Israel. And I believe in that count, they're counting 1 girl who's 16, who's an Arab Israeli. So, I mean, the children are really, there's just been such a high number of child casualties in this violence. And international calls are really focused on that, trying to bring the parties to their senses. And all the members of the Security Council condemned the violence on both sides, told them, Israel, you have a right to defend yourself, but you must do it proportionately and in line with international humanitarian law. But to Hamas, they said, you must stop the indiscriminate rocket attack. So both sides have blame here. On Tuesday, the European Union foreign ministers will meet. In the meantime, the UN Secretary General is trying to resurrect the long dormant quartet on Middle East peace to try and get them to have a foreign minister level meeting. So there's a lot of diplomacy going on, but whether it will stop anything, I don't know, because the Israeli ambassador said, we've made our decision. We're here to stop Hamas.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. American Muslim organizations boycotted Sunday's White House virtual Eid celebration marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan to protest what they see as the Biden administration's support of Israel violence against Palestinians. White House correspondent Patsy Wedes-Kuwara has the story.
Eid al-Fitr is usually a time of joy and celebration for Muslims around the world. But this year, Eid is marred, and not just by the pandemic, but by the escalating violence between Israelis and Palestinians, causing some American Muslim organizations to boycott the White House virtual Eid celebration Sunday. Robert McCaw is the Government Affairs Director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations has joined other national American Muslim organizations in boycotting tonight's virtual White House Eid celebration due to the Biden administration's increasing and disappointingly disturbing response to the Israeli government's human rights abuses against Palestinians in Gaza and East Jerusalem.
Beginning with Bill Clinton in 1996, American presidents have hosted iftar, or the breaking of the Ramadan fast, at the White House. This year, President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden hosted Eid virtually.
We can see the spirit of this day in the millions of Muslim Americans who make our country stronger every day, including so many courageous frontline workers.
President Biden acknowledged that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict weighs heavily on Muslims around the world.
My administration is going to continue to engage Palestinians and Israelis and other regional partners to work towards sustained calm.
On Saturday, thousands rallied in major U.S. cities, including Washington, New York, and Boston, demanding the Biden administration do more to address human rights abuses by the Israeli government against Palestinians. Palestinian-American Siham Esheikh.
We are tired of the killings of the innocent. We are tired of the occupation.
Making Israel's case for self-defense, Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, spoke to the UN Security Council Sunday, saying the conflict was premeditated by Hamas.
This is not the first time that Hamas has indiscriminately fired deadly missiles at Israeli civilians while hiding behind Palestinian civilians.
Over the weekend, Biden spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas. The administration has also sent envoys to the region. Marissa Kurma is the program director of the Middle East program at the Wilson Center.
The most immediate steps that have to be taken, which it seems that they are taking, is to play a role in de-escalating and ensuring that we do not see this current violence flare up or blow out of control.
Before the violence, Biden had made little effort to restart stalled peace negotiations. Now he is under pressure to do so, not just from American Muslims, but also from lawmakers in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Patsy Wedes-Kuwara, VOA News.
The U.S. government is warning extremists may strike as coronavirus restrictions are eased. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The alert from the Department of Homeland Security does not mention any specific threats. Testifying before a Senate committee earlier this week, Attorney General Merrick Garland says, according to the FBI, the most serious domestic violence threat comes from
racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocate for the superiority of the white race.
The virus has spawned conspiracy theories and deepened anger by some at the government over the shutdown of the economy. As conditions improve, the alert says new dangers loom. DHS has also established a new domestic terrorism branch with its Office of Intelligence and Analysis. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Americans are grappling with the guidance by the Center for Disease Control late last week that if they are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, for the most part, they can go without a mask outside and inside. Michelle Quinn reports.
Just one-third of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, and one-fourth consistently tells pollsters they don't plan to get one of the three available vaccines. So Americans, retailers, and health officials were surprised last week when the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said fully vaccinated individuals could go without face coverings, with a few exceptions. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says the guidance is about individual responsibility.
If they're vaccinated, they are safe. If they are not vaccinated, they are not safe. They should still be wearing a mask or, better yet, get vaccinated.
Some public health leaders criticize the guidance as too abrupt and confusing since it's not clear who is vaccinated. The Biden administration has said it won't create a national vaccine passport. The new CDC guidance has revived discussion around a vaccine card so that businesses and others know if people have been inoculated. Walensky says the guidance is not permission for widespread removal of masks, but for each person to take their health into their own hands. For the unvaccinated, the guidance hasn't changed, she said. Last week, U.S. President Joe Biden, appearing without a mask, alongside Vice President Kamala Harris, described the updated guidance as a great day for America. The CDC's guidance spurred change throughout the country, with some retailers dropping the mask requirement for vaccinated shoppers. Others say they will maintain their current rules as they review the guidance. A union representing 1.3 million food and retail workers said the guidance could put its members at risk.
What we're asking our businesses to do as they are starting to think about the guidance as to what this means for their workplaces is to make it easy for paid time off for their employees to get vaccinated.
Not all states are ready to loosen their rules, and masks and social distancing are still required on planes and other public transportation. Meanwhile, some states and businesses are coming up with novel ways to encourage people to get vaccinated, such as free train rides, pints of beer, and even money, as they try to return their communities to normal. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
A growing number of people around the world are dying from heart disease and stroke because of overwork, a new study by the World Health Organization and the International Labor Organization says. The study is based on data from more than 2,300 surveys collected in 154 countries from 1970 to 2018. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The study says those working at least 55 hours a week are at higher risk of dying from heart disease and stroke. In 2016, the data show 1 in 10 people around the world, or 450 million, worked excessively long hours, leading to 745,000 heart disease and stroke deaths. Frank Pega, a technical officer in WHO's Department of Environment, Climate Change and Health, says this is a 29% increase since 2000.
We know that this burden disproportionately affects men. 70% of all deaths from cardiovascular disease occur in men, according to our official estimates. Also, the regions that are most affected are Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific. And we can tell you that it appears that middle-aged and older workers are disproportionately burdened.
The study reports most recorded deaths are among those aged 60 to 79 who have worked for 55 hours or more per week. The lowest recorded number is in Africa, which has a young population. It says Europe and North America have the lowest occupational disease rates. It says this is because people in these regions are largely covered by employment protections that limit the number of hours they work. The new analysis highlights the impact the COVID-19 pandemic has on workers who increasingly are working from home. Pega says teleworking and the digitization of work appear to be speeding the trend toward long working hours.
We have some evidence that shows that when countries go into national lockdown, the numbers of hours work increased by about 10%. We also have a sort of massive increase in digitization of work, and digitization of work might actually make it harder to disconnect. Rest periods and personal periods might need to be scheduled when you're working online, right? Because otherwise you might be working very long hours.
Health and occupational safety officials urge nations to consider the well-being of their populations as the world enters the post-COVID recovery period. They say governments must ensure that recovery measures are not pursued at the expense of the health of workers. They say governments should introduce and enforce laws that ban mandatory overtime and ensure limits on maximum working times. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Groups alleging human rights abuses against minorities in China are calling for a full boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. The move is likely to ratchet up pressure on the International Olympic Committee, athletes, sponsors, and sports federations. A coalition representing Uyghurs, Tibetans, and residents of Hong Kong and others have issued a statement calling for the boycott. The Beijing Games are set to open on February 4, 2022. Samoa appears set to get its first woman leader after the nation's top court on Monday reinstated the results of a knife-edge election last month. Two decisions by the Supreme Court have paved the way for Fiamme Naomi Mataafa to become Prime Minister of the small island nation. Her ascent represents a significant milestone not only for Samoa, but for the broader South Pacific region, where there have been fewer women leaders. Like many of its neighbors, Samoa tends to be conservative, strongly Christian, and deeply traditional. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. UN agencies are urging policymakers to lower speed limits in a bid to cut traffic deaths and injuries. A campaign to get people to, quote, slow down on the roads, unquote, will be launched Monday at the start of the United Nations Global Road Safety Week. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Every year, more than 1.3 million people die in road traffic crashes and 50 million are injured. One person dies every 24 seconds because of a crash. The United Nations says car crash injuries are the eighth leading cause of death globally for all age groups. It is also the leading cause of death among children and young adults between the ages of 5 and 29. The focus of this year's Global Road Safety Week is to encourage policymakers to drop speed limits to 30 kilometers an hour in cities where cyclists and pedestrians interact closely with car traffic. The head of security and mobility at the World Health Organization, Nan Tran, says reducing the speed limit to 30 kilometers per hour in city streets will save lives.
Most people, most cyclists, pedestrians will survive if they're hit by a car traveling at 30 kilometers per hour or 20 miles per hour. Beyond that speed limit, the risk of death becomes much higher, and that's why we consider 30 kilometers per hour or 20 miles per hour a safe speed, because it means that most people will survive.
Slower speed, he says, has other benefits in making cities more livable. Tran notes cars are a big source of carbon dioxide emissions. He says slower speed will result in a significant drop in emissions, which will improve air quality. Since early last year, he says COVID-19 lockdowns and an increase in the number of people working from home has led to a marked decrease in the number of people driving. However, he adds, this has not resulted in fewer traffic deaths.
In fact, although we have observed a reduction in the amount of traffic and, in fact, in the amount of crashes, what we have seen is that there has been an increase in severity of crashes because the roads have been empty due to confinement and lockdown, and people have taken that as an opportunity to actually speed, and they're taking this opportunity to drive faster, and therefore you're seeing more fatal crashes.
The WHO reports Africa is the region with the highest number of road traffic fatalities in the world, with a rate of about 26 per 100,000 population. This against 10 fatalities per 100,000 in the Europe region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Expatriate Indian doctors in Australia have formed an emergency group to help overwhelmed colleagues and relatives struggling with COVID-19 back home. Also in Australia, a special task force is urging the government to abandon what some have termed a fortress approach to the pandemic due to the country's decision to keep international borders shut. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Settlers from India are Australia's second largest group of migrants behind those from England. They've become a valuable part of society and the economy. Now expatriate medical professionals from India have come together to help their colleagues back home during the pandemic. The Indian health system has been under immense strain because of an avalanche of COVID-19 infections and fatalities. The populous South Asian nation is at the heart of the global pandemic. The World Health Organization has reported 25 million infections and more than 270,000 virus-related deaths. Indian migrant doctors in Australia are dispensing medical advice through phone lines and via the internet about hospital treatment and drugs to help patients in India fend off coronavirus infections. Yardu Singh is a cardiologist in Sydney and president of the Federation of Indian Associations of New South Wales State. He says they're doing what they can to help anxious patients in India.
We became the secondary doctors. We can't prescribe medicine sitting in Sydney, but we were able to counsel them, stop them from getting panic, and also to counsel them about what they should do to not pass on the infection.
Australia's response to the pandemic has received global praise, but an alliance of education, migration and legal experts has said the nation risks being left behind if its isolationist approach to COVID-19 continues. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thailand's border closure in response to the coronavirus has crippled the economy, and a new wave of the virus has killed at least 400 people since April 1st. As pressure mounts to speed up a sluggish vaccine rollout, Bangkok's main airport has become an unlikely location for shots. Vijitra Drangdi reports for VOA from Bangkok.
Checking in for an inoculation at Thailand's main airport, Suvarnabhumi. The few passengers here during a pandemic find empty concourses and abandoned luggage carts as the facility prepares to become a mass vaccination site to help the country deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. Check-in desks have been converted to mini-clinics, doling out shots of China's Sinovac vaccine, and waiting areas are used by the newly inoculated to rest and be monitored after they receive their shots. 4,000 airport staff are among the first wave in the tourist-dependent country to receive shots. The airport is accustomed to processing large numbers of people, and now being readied for large-scale public vaccinations as the government struggles to beat back a third wave of the virus, the deadliest yet.
Before the pandemic, we used to receive 200,000 international travelers a day. Now only about 1,000 a day. The airport already has all the necessary amenities ready to turn into a vaccination station, such as check-in counters and other equipment.
Over 400 people have been killed in Thailand since a resurgence in the virus in April. Thailand's daily caseload of around 2,000 is small compared to the worst-hit countries, but it is a large number for a country that as recently as March thought it had virtually extinguished the virus with lockdowns and border restrictions. Vijitra Arundi for VOA News, Bangkok.
Australia's oldest ever man has included eating chicken brains among his secrets to live more than 111 years. Retired cattle rancher Dexter Kruger on Monday marked 124 days since he turned 111, the day older than World War I veteran Jack Luckett was when he died in 2022. Kruger told Australian Broadcasting Corporation in an interview at his nursing home in the rural town of Roma that eating chicken brains weekly had contributed to his longevity. The oldest ever verified Australian was Christina Cook, who died in 2002, aged 104 years and 148 days. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.